Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to a special midweek podcast edition of Unbelievable. This is Justin Brierley, your show host, but in a break from the usual format of the show, what you're going to hear today is a radio feature that I presented recently on Premier Christian Radio to mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II in the Far East. I hope wherever you are on the faith spectrum, you'll enjoy it, and you're always welcome to send me your feedback to unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Hello, I'm Justin Brierley, welcoming you to a special bank holiday programme being broadcast to mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II in the Far East. On the 2nd of September 1945, Japan formally surrendered to the Allies. The task then began of repatriating the surviving prisoners of war who'd been captured in the Far East during the campaign. One of those survivors was my grandfather, Geoffrey Mowat. This two-part programme, The Rainbow Through the Rain, which traces his spiritual journey as a POW, was first broadcast 10 years ago to mark the 60th anniversary of VJ Day. And in the same year, it received first prize in the Church of England's Sanford St Martin Awards for religious broadcasting. The drum dissections are taken from Geoff's POW memoirs, The Rainbow Through the Rain. My grandfather passed away a few years later, so this re-airing is dedicated to his memory and that of my grandmother, Louise, from whom he was parted for almost 4 years during his time in captivity. You can listen again and also read my accompanying feature in Premier Christianity magazine by visiting the links at premierchristianradio.com/rainbowthroughtherain. In 1940, during the Second World War, Geoffrey Mowat travelled to Malaysia with his wife Louise to start a new life in the colonial service. Unbeknown to him, they'd be separated for over 3 years as Geoff was captured by the Japanese and became a prisoner of war. This is his story.
It was magical to be sailing away on the Viceroy of India on our honeymoon, because Louise and I got married only after we received permission from the governor of Singapore that was in order. We only got that 10 days before the ship sailed. So it was wonderful to have our honeymoon on this grand liner. And arrive in Singapore about the middle of September 1940. We lived under the threat of a war with Japan all those months, and the balloon eventually went up at the end of November 1941. So I received a telephone message from the adjutant of my unit to return immediately to Malacca. The following day, or perhaps the day after, with our contingent, we got on the train at Malacca, hurrying down to Singapore, while Louise was left in the bungalow. She had to fend for herself, but she couldn't stay there. The war progressed so rapidly, with the Japanese coming down the peninsula, that within a matter of 3 weeks, she had to pack up and follow me to Singapore. I'd been conscripted, and I'd done my basic training and all that. The day came for Louise to go with her friends in GHQ to Java. I was second in charge of a machine gun post near the Singapore Swimming Club, and she just walked down. She had walked from her temporary lodgings in Catton Grange, and we had a few minutes, and I took off my signet ring. I said, well, this isn't till we meet again. We were young enough to feel elated at this moment. In spite of the separation, we had no idea what lay ahead. In the event, things moved so swiftly that capitulation was a matter of 6 weeks away. And the bulk of us had to walk the 16 miles to the promontory of Changi in the eastern part of the island, where a huge number of troops were quartered in what had been barracks. Fine concrete buildings in three floors, roomy and airy, which of course had to house 10 times the number they were built for.
Wednesday, the 18th of February. Our captivity had properly begun. It was remarkable how early on the rock-bottom instincts of man began to assert themselves. Everyone scrounged, thieved, jockeyed for positions, hoarded and overate with the utmost intensity, and I at once felt heartily sick of the whole atmosphere. I refused to accumulate a vast quantity of rubbish which might or might not come in useful at a later date. I went down to the sea and had a wonderful swim. I talked at length with Elliot over the possibilities of making an escape. I ate slender meals and tried not to feel hungry. The weather was magnificent, but hot, and because of the shortage of water, everyone was terribly thirsty. Organisation so far was deplorable. Latrines, shallow and open, speedily became pestilential spots. It was obvious that if these conditions endured, dysentery and other related diseases would ravage the encampment in no time.
A friend in Jeff's company of volunteers had hatched a plan to escape. His name was Bob Elliott.
He was a very adventurous type, and he, from the outset, he said, I'm not going to bear the imprisonment. What about it? I'm planning to escape. Would you like to come with me? So, it didn't take me long to decide. A matter of pride, really. So within 4 days of the capitulation, we simply walked out of the encircling camp at Changi Barracks. There were, of course, there was no barbed wire at that point. We simply walked out with as much as we thought suitable to carry and headed our way to cross the strait into the mainland. We were on the move for some 6 weeks in the jungle and on the edge of civilised areas for some 6 weeks as we tramped up the state of Johor in the south, hoping to come to a point in the mainland where we could get hold of a ship and so to India. It was a tremendous adventure on its own, neither of us having any experience of jungle life, and very ill prepared for it.
Still we pressed on through the rubber, then through a much-neglected oil palm estate, for maybe a couple of hours in the gathering darkness under the twinkling stars. We were looking for some sign of habitation, for food and directions as usual. At last, we spied a light in the distance, and soon the sound of that lovely tune, which has become the national anthem of Malaysia, Terang Bulan, came to our ears. We hastened towards it. Surely we would find friends there. It was a Kongsi house, all right, but they had no food to spare. However, they gave us bowls of the most delicious sweet coffee and a guide to set us on the road to another Kongsi, where we would be sure to get a meal. It was on the way to Chembi, too, they said. A young Chinese accompanied us for a mile or so, taking us by side paths through the oil palms, and then left us, where a goodish track led towards the other Kongsi and the jungle proper. The way was long, but we trudged on and on, passing one house deserted but for three Chinese. This was not the right one, and so we went on again. The Great Bear rose ahead of us.
That was a very alarming incident. We were, it was not a road, it was just a path through a jungle area. We were following this young Chinese lad with two big loads on a kandar stick. When I heard a sound behind us, I turned around to my astonishment, there within 20 or 30 yards were these two Japanese on cycles. Ellie said, "Quick, in," and we dived into the secondary growth at the edge of this path. We were lost to view at once, so there was no hope in finding us. But, of course, we don't know what happened to that unhappy Chinese with his load. I've always wondered whether he was taken. The Chinese were naturally opposed to the Japanese, and so they did all they could to help us. Without the help from the Chinese, we wouldn't have got very far.
March 23rd. Downstream again we toiled, now in the river, now cutting our way through the jungle, or trying to find a decent path which the Jakun assured us we would strike. My fever came on again at noon, preceded by a violent bout of shivering. Yes, this must be the malaria we had been so much dreading. Nothing else could recur with such regularity. Elliot had fever too, though his did not keep the same timetable as mine. Then, after my temperature had risen and risen, I would break out into a gentle sweat and would thank God that the fever had gone for the time being. Then I would perk up, talk with Elliot, and be able to appreciate something of the grand scenery. And the rest of the evening, followed by sweet sleep, would be a blessed release after the hellish slog of the day.
We had a run of good luck, apart from my falling sick with malaria. I went down with it after about 5 weeks. As we had no quinine, it was necessary to try to get some, and so ran the risk of dangers of civilization and malaise in particular. That's what proved our undoing. Yes, we thought we'd get out of this by going downstream, and I was on the point of loosing a small dugout canoe and to sail down this small stream when the owner appeared and I was in trouble. This Malay promised to bring us food, but instead he brought some of his friends, and it was clear that we were going to be taken and handed over. So we tried a feeble resistance, but we had no firearms, and that would have been dangerous. I sustained a severe cut on the left side of my head, didn't quite slice the ear off, and another one on my left shin. Well, the Malays handed us over to the Japanese nearby village centre, where we were subjected to shameful procedure. I was feeling very ill with the first field dressing on my head, and we were sitting outside the police station for all of the day, with Malays passing by being the object of can't describe it.
It was April 1942, and Jeff's first real taste of conditions for a prisoner of war of the Japanese was soon to come, as he was sent to Pudu Jail.
Conditions in Pudu Jail were really frightful. Because of my wound, I was put into what had been the female ward, but it was a temporary makeshift hospital. It was very good. There were some medical personnel, but what they had very little to use. There was one chap who was delirious. I had intermittent fever besides pain from my head wound, but I was befriended by a very nice Scotsman, and he really looked after me and brought me my food, did his best to keep me clean and changed, fresh clothes. Malnutrition began to bite severely, and many chaps went down with the beriberi and pellagra. I began to find my left eye suffering. I had to put an eye patch over it. But the condition was only temporary. As soon as diet improved, my sight returned to normal. As the days progressed and the place got more organised, we had some wonderful shows that were presented in the central well of the jail. Any sort of variety, from solo items to sketches. Great fun. We were in a kind of humour where we were prepared to enjoy anything.
On the church side, we were blessed by the presence of the Church of England Padre, Noel Duckworth, a charismatic little man who in his day had been Cox of the Cambridge Eight. With his persuasive manner and marvellous sense of humour, he was able to secure us many concessions. Over a period of several months, Padre Duckworth was, quite amazingly, allowed to leave the jail every day and go about his business in the town unattended. I believe he wore a white cassock to distinguish himself from other POWs, and the local people would recognise him for what he was. Each day he would go shopping and return with a pack bulging with tins or fruit to supplement the diet of the sick. On one occasion, when I was recovering from a bout of malaria, he dropped in to cell 226 and insisted on my having a tin of powdered milk. It was one of those gifts which can never be repaid, quite without price in that situation. Besides helping sick and wounded in this kind of way, and holding dynamic Sunday services in the prison yard, Duckworth proposed the formation of a prayer fellowship. This was to meet once a week in the narrow room by the main gate, set aside and furnished as a chapel, and also to support members individually through intercessory prayer during the days between.
We had so little to live on. The food was very scarce, very poor. Padre Duckworth suggested that we start a prayer group so we could reach for higher things and feel it. And we did. It was extraordinary how that small prayer group was effective in helping us to recover our morale and generally find life more tolerable. As a result of this prayer group, I was able to shake off my malaria entirely. It didn't recur until the last days, 2 years later, when I was in Thailand. The Japanese were never hostile to anything we might propose in the way of church services. And in a settled camp like this, before long, the engineers had somehow collected the necessary equipment for a simple sanctuary and altar. Of course, it was open and just with planks on chunks of wood to sit on. There were army biscuits that were used for bread. But as for wine, no, we never had wine. I can't remember what was used. Probably tea.
Eventually, Jeff's relatively quiet life in Pudu Jail was to be interrupted. The Japanese war effort was intensifying. Prisoners of war were required to work on the infrastructure of the country, and Jeff soon found out where his next months would lie.
There were whispers of a railway, but we thought we were going to a rest camp where the food would be much better. In the event, it proved vastly different and led to one of the toughest periods of my POW days that anybody could experience. Very physical, added to which the dangers you ran in working in jungle situation. So many chaps went down with ulcers These could soon eat to the bone and result in death, especially if you had to have your leg amputated. Well, the work was varied for the building of this railway and often very dangerous. There was one group put on bridge building using logs hewn from the jungle. very dangerous. I can only remember being on a bridge party for 1 or 2 days in one particular camp called Tonshin. But after a matter of a week or two, with others, we marched a couple of days further north to the camp which I was in for most of the rest of the time, called Hintock, Hintock River Camp. And this was where some 100 or more of us were based, being required to work on what we call the cutting, which proved to be the quarrying of the rock, what later came to be called Hellfire Pass. You, with the hammer and chisel, you had to cut so many meters or fill up your meter each day before you're allowed to go back to camp. You had to do it. They wouldn't allow to bludge the Australians. So they kept an eye on you.
I celebrated my 26th birthday on the cutting, and remember this because I landed a bashing from one of the Jap engineers. No doubt he thought I was not working hard enough for a subject of the Emperor, and of course, he was right. After that, I went down with an attack of enteritis and got a couple of days off work. That was a blessed rest indeed, and here the Japs were not so ruthless in driving out the sick to work as they were to become later on, but then the number of fit men was still relatively high. While I was bed down in camp, I got the most pleasant surprise. To my great joy, my heavy pack arrived in a consignment of baggage from the base camp. A great piece of luck, as only 2 lorry loads ever came through. Besides now having some clean clothes, razor, soap and so on, I got my previous blanket, which was now absolutely essential, as the nights became quite cold. By way of light work to help my recovery, I was detailed to work in the Japanese cookhouse. This was easy, but it was also monotonous and a continual strain. One had a constant craving to pilfer pieces of fish, meat, and anything that happened to be around. And of course, severe punishment was meted out for anything discovered. Once, another chap and I were put on to sorting eggs, picking out the bad from a basket containing some too gross. We did the job and included a few good ones among our choice of bad, hoping to get away with them. In the end, the Japanese cook never bothered to check the bad eggs, which we later swiped, hiding them in the rubbish pit until we got the chance of removing them in our haversacks.
Men fell sick with jungle sores and malaria and other things. But Japanese had to fill their tally of prisoners for the job, and so sick were pulled out, marched up, and many collapsed, had to be carried back to camp. Together with this, there was the outbreak of cholera, because among the many working on this railway for the Japanese, there's a large number of civilians, mostly Indians, brought up from Malaya. These were the first to go down with cholera. But of course, we were probably drawing our water from the same water that they used, and we were quickly infected. I lost 2 of my best friends from cholera in the camp above us. That was where the cholera took such a toll. Yes, it was terrible. Well, after some 6 weeks on this cutting, I volunteered to work in the hospital area of Hintock River Camp. I was given charge of a tent 13 with 21 sick men in it. These were young men from South Wales, heavy ack, thrown into the campaign in Malaya, straight from the ships in Singapore. They had no opportunity to acclimatise, totally unsuited for this. And one by one they lost hope and died. So while I was looking after these unfortunate men, over a period of some 6 weeks, I think I lost two-thirds of them.
One of my most pitiful cases was a young bombardier whose name became symbolic to me, Freeman. He lay on the bamboo slats, to all intents and purposes naked, but covered with a square of dirty blanket. He had had dysentery, but wasn't purging anymore, and was quite helpless. When I came to see him that morning to clean him up, I turned him over and was appalled to see what I shall hope never to see again. Maggots crawling in and out of his anus. I said nothing, and did what I could, but mentioned this to the M.O. as soon as I had the chance. "Oh, you needn't worry about that," he said. "They are quite healthy things, and do a good job while they're about it." By next morning, I need not have worried for Freeman, for he had died, leaving this world maggots and all. But I felt sorry as I wrapped him in his blanket and went to report his death to the M.O., as he seemed to be a spirit whom the degrading circumstances of that camp could not quench. He had been unable to speak, but had smiled his thanks to me to the end.
That was the first part of The Rainbow Through the Rain. Join me, Justin Brierley, in a few minutes for part two, as we continue to trace the prisoner of war experience of my grandfather, Geoffrey Mowat, and read the story in full at premierchristianradio.com/rainbowthroughtherain.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Jesus had completed his earthly ministry by the relatively young age of 33. In the latest edition of the magazine, we profile 33, 33 and unders, following in his footsteps by doing fresh things for God in their youth. We also meet TV preacher Joyce Meyer to talk passion and prosperity. Plus, be inspired by the testimonies of ex-convict James and ex-drug addict Susie. All that and much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Hello, I'm Justin Brierley, welcoming you back for the second part of The Rainbow Through the Rain here on Premier Christian Radio, a re-airing of a special feature tracing the spiritual journey of my grandfather, Geoffrey Mowat, as a POW in the Far East 70 years ago. You can listen again and also read the accompanying feature in Premier Christianity magazine by visiting the links at premierchristianradio.com/rainbowthroughtherain. In 1940, Geoffrey Mowat went with his wife Louise to work in the colonial service in Malaysia. They would endure almost 4 years of separation as Jeff was captured and held as a POW by the Japanese. We pick up the story as Jeff spent several months labouring with other prisoners on the Burma-Thailand Railway.
I was lucky to come through the Japanese time, certainly. Oh, yes. Good God is economical. But I was a fit person, I suppose. I mean, I'd been acclimatised. I knew how to survive. So I came through that dreadful time in Thailand better than many people. Towards the end, I began to suffer a small ulcer on my shin, jungle ulcer. I was in charge of that hospital tent, Tintok, and the doctor there, when the camp was breaking up, gave me 5 M&B tablets. How he had somehow saved these up for all those years. He said, eat 3 at intervals, powder, make powder of the other one, and rub this into your ulcer. That did the trick.
We were chatting quietly among ourselves. Some were smoking, some were dozing. It was the hour when the jungle trees were falling into shadow, when the cicadas began to stay their interminable chirr-chirr, and the stars were coming out to prick the sky with points of silver. When, from the camp, there came a sound which immediately transfixed every one of us. It was a trumpet. A trumpet quite beautifully played, the notes coming with absolute distinctness and purity across the intervening distance. Someone was playing old music hall tunes, the London Derriere, for instance, and wartime melodies like Far, Far on the Range and When They Sound the Last All Clear, tunes which tugged at the heartstrings with more than a touch of irony, as they sounded so purely in the depths of that jungle clearing. The concert ended, but there was one more thing before the unknown trumpeter broke off. It was the playing of The Last Post. If ever we needed light in dark places, if ever we needed encouragement in despair, if ever we needed strength which comes from fellowship, we had it then in abundance.
Jeff recalls a number of moments when the vivid sense of God's presence was very real during his captivity.
I was separated from the others, and it was the end of the daytime shift, so it was coming on dusk, and I found myself walking down this jungle path towards our camp by the river, when I suddenly felt the need to burst into song, so I find myself remembering a piece from Mendelssohn's Elijah, "O Rest in the Lord." So it must be very strange. Nobody else could hear me because I was quite by myself to have this religious song coming through the trees. I've treasured that experience. It brought home to me how God is there in the midst of all our trouble and despair.
It happened to be a fine morning after the rain, with the damp hillside steaming in the sunshine. Whether it was a Sunday or not, I cannot say, but Padre Headley proposed to hold a communion service on a patch of open ground between the hospital area and the other tented lines. Perhaps there were a dozen or so. It was a day like any other, and the fit men would have been on a shift at the cutting. So the men attending were those confined to camp by the MO, or, like myself, helping as cooks or orderlies. The picture is as clear as if it took place yesterday. The padre with his chaplain's scarf, the ragged and emaciated men kneeling, if they could, to receive this sacrament of God's love. It was, after all, a sacrament of life and of peace.
Ultimately, a sudden evacuation of the camp led to Jeff being moved again, along with other prisoners of war. 10 days before Christmas 1943, Jeffrey was relocated to another POW camp, Syme Road, which in former days had been a golf course, but was now in quite different use.
I suppose 2,000 or 3,000 of us were established in the hutted area of this camp, which was a vast improvement of what we'd known. As a prisoner of war camp, it was in a good situation. It was healthy, open, and there were no working parties except to provide for our local needs. It was there that I met some very interesting men. In particular, I made friends with another Malay volunteer called Kenneth Luke, who remains one of my closest friends today. He was in the Malay Education Service, had been a headmaster at one of the prime schools, very positive in his attitudes, and we quickly became great friends. And he led me to meet an extraordinary man, lovely person, a Dutchman, Dutch officer, regular officer, called Oswald Godin. He was a spiritual man with some particular, wonderful spiritual gifts. He attracted men to him, and we would gather around him, perhaps 10 or a dozen in the evening, when he would talk with us or take some text and expound it and provide the basis for wonderful spiritual activity.
All these associations caused Jeff to seriously consider the vocation of ministry in the Anglican Church. He was spurred on in his thoughts by a Church of England padre in the camp.
Eric Cordingley. He had been vicar of Lakehampton, Cheltenham, before the war. And he and I quickly struck up a great friendship. Naturally, we got in touch with others of like mind. And before long, there were some half a dozen of us who were being schooled by Padre Cordingley in preparation perhaps for ordination to the ministry. What finally drew my thoughts in this direction was my experience I had at Hintock River Camp and that tent of 20 odd very sick soldiers who were in my charge. And well, I ministered to their needs as best I could. I felt very ill-prepared and insufficient to meet all their needs. There was an Anglican padre in that camp. His name was Headley. And when one of these men in my camp became delirious, I asked him to come along. Would he come along and pray with this chap who was off his chump and just wanting to die? So we did our best, but he died the next day. But he had the ministry of this priest to help him over that last stage. And all this made me think deeply about what I lacked in my present capacities to help people in such extremities.
Before his captivity, Jeff had been married to Louise for a mere 18 months. She had been evacuated from the Far East as the war broke out. Contact had since been very sparse, the inconsistency of the prisoner of war post being mostly to blame.
For months and months there was nothing, and then I had perhaps 10 or 12 letters that had accumulated in twos and threes through the vagaries of prisoner of war post. So I had these letters, which was great encouragement. The best was this photographs was enclosed in a letter which I received from Louise when she was in Melbourne in 1942, and it reached me in Changi Prison on 17th December 1944. It took some time for me to realise, but the star she wore in her lapel had US underneath, indicating that she was working for some unit in the American forces. She was in a civilian capacity at this point, working as secretary to one of MacArthur's deputy chiefs of staff in Australia, in the southwest Pacific Organization. I was over the moon when I received this.
By the beginning of October 1944, I became certain in my mind that I would be ready to offer myself for ordination at the end of the war if the call to this vocation remained clear and compelling. In reaching this position, there were two factors. First, the insistent voice of conscience prodding me on, and secondly, the fear of a cool response or possible outright rejection from Louise when we eventually came together. While my determination to leave the colonial service and go for ordination was dominant, I knew I had to hold everything in tension and discover what had been happening to her in her separate life in the meantime.
Gradually, it became apparent that the Japanese were losing World War II.
Chinese approaching us through the wire of our makeshift camp told us some extraordinary bomb had been exploded in Japan. This was the first of the atomic bombs. And within 48 hours, we couldn't help noticing that the Japanese officers were busy collecting and burning their records from behind their locked doors. Through the wire, we learned that the war was finished, the war was over. Well, there's plenty of evidence that towards the end, many groups were digging their own graves in camps outside Singapore. But in our case, we came to realise that we'd probably be herded into the central square and machine gunned.
While we waited for repatriation procedures to get underway, boredom was our chief enemy. So, with my Thailand experience behind me, I again volunteered as an orderly in the hospital, and to my delight was taken on as a dresser for Major Fagan, an Australian and a fine surgeon, who had done much brilliant work in camp hospitals on the railway. I was quite happy and quite enjoyed swabbing out enormous or creeping ulcers and applying dressings. It was on such a morning, the 11th of September, when I was busy on the ward, that I heard my name over the tannoy system. Wondering what on earth this might be, dressed in an old pair of khaki shorts, I went along to be greeted by none other than an American officer, who introduced himself as Major General H.H. Fuller, Deputy Chief of Staff to Lord Louis Mountbatten, the head of Southeast Asia Command. Was I Lieutenant Corporal 80588 Mowat of the Straits Settlements Volunteer Force? I assented. Well, he drawled, I have some news for you. I saw your wife in Manila a month back. She's a captain in the Women's Army Corps, and she's serving as confidential secretary to General MacArthur's Deputy Chief of Staff out there. I offered to contact you if it were possible. My whole being surged with emotion at this amazing news, and I didn't know what to say. The general then questioned me regarding my repatriation. To this, I replied that I believed my wife to be in Australia, and had asked for repatriation there accordingly. He said he would cable right away to Manila with information of my safety and intention to be evacuated to Australia. The interview terminated with my thanks, a handshake and a salute. And I made my way back to the lines with my spirits going over the moon.
Jeff's excitement at his reunion with Louise on his release from the camp was only tempered by his knowledge that she had always been averse to the idea of marrying a vicar.
Any response of mine had to take into account the meeting, as I hoped, the eventual meeting with Louise, and wondering how she would react. What did I say? I had to be open-minded about this and find out what her feelings might be on this subject. Yes, it was very scary. We had been apart for nearly 4 years, you see. Who knows? Both of us had changed. We'd had our own experiences. And we didn't know what kind of a partner we would be meeting. However, God is great, and he enabled us to overcome all sorts of problems. Years later, when my time in Malaya was clearly coming to an end, and I happened to be driving the bishop to catch his plane from Kuala Lumpur, and he said to me, "Mert, what do you intend to do when you retire from the civil service?" So then I had to tell him, well, I had been thinking of going into the ministry of the church. But Louise had not been sympathetic to this. So we had to talk about it. And eventually I felt able to put this question to Louise again, and she was able to go along with me. The experience under the Japanese couldn't just be sloughed off in a matter of days. And indeed, it took me some years before I could finally come to terms with my feelings towards them. I remember particularly when I was a district officer at Butterworth, in crossing by ferry from Butterworth to Georgetown, I'd pass Japanese ships with a red flag at the masthead, the red sun on the white background. And this would stir up my feelings to a pitch which were quite extraordinary. So I had to get over that. Some years later, I can never forget the day when I was in my office and the clerk at the telephone said that I was called from the Japanese consulate in Singapore. Would I take the call? Well, it was a very difficult moment. However, I couldn't say no. I had to do this. But it was a breakthrough, you see. I had to attend to the business as best I could. But I then had to examine myself and say, well, this can't go on. I can't go on maintaining this attitude, and to pray that if I couldn't change it, God had to change me. 30 or more years later, when I was in Singapore, I found myself having to preach to a Japanese congregation. I think God helped me to laugh at that, and manage it all right.
You've been listening to a special feature to mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II in the Far East, following the surrender of Japan to the Allies. If you'd like to purchase a copy of Geoffrey Mowat's POW memoirs, The Rainbow Through the Rain, that the programme was based on, then simply email rainbowttr@btinternet.com. You can also listen again and read my accompanying feature in Premier Christianity magazine by visiting the links at premierchristianradio.com/rainbow through the rain.